My Lady Lostrice's voice became shriller with the edge of hysteria in it. Mix me the poison draught now, this instant, while I watch you do it. I order you to do it. You dare not disobey me. This command was so loud that even the guards at the outer gates must be able to hear her, and I dared not argue longer. Very well, my lady, I will do it. I will fetch my chest of medicine from my rooms. When I returned with the chest under my arm, she was up from the bed and pacing around her chamber with glittering eyes in that pale, tragic face. "I'm watching you. Don't try any of your tricks on me now," she warned me, as I prepared the draught from the scarlet glass bottle. She knew that colour warned of the lethal contents. When I handed the bowl to her, she showed no fear and paused only to kiss my cheek. "You have been both father and loving brother to me. I thank you for this last kindness. I love you, Taita, and I shall miss you." She lifted the bowl in both hands, as though it were a wassail cup rather than a fatal potion. "Thanos, my darling," she toasted him with it, "they shall never take me from you. We shall meet again on the far side." And she drained the bowl at a swallow, then dropped it to shatter on the floor. At last, with a sigh, she fell back upon the bed. "Come. Sit beside me. I am afraid to be alone when I die." Taken on her empty stomach, the effect of the draught was very rapid. She had only time to turn her face to me and whisper, "Tell Thanos again how much I loved him, unto the portals of death and beyond." Then her eyes closed, and she was gone. She lay so still and pale that for a moment I was truly alarmed, afraid that I had misjudged the strength of the powder of the red chepen which I had substituted for the essence of the deadly datura pod. It was only when I held a bronze hand mirror to her mouth that the clouded surface reassured me that she still breathed. I covered her gently and tried to convince myself that in the morning she would be resigned to the fact that she was still alive and that she would forgive me. At that moment there was a peremptory knock upon the door of the outer chamber, and I recognized the voice of Aton, the royal chamberlain, demanding entrance. He was another eunuch, one of the special brotherhood of the emasculated, so I could count him as a friend. I hurried through to greet him. "I have come to fetch your little mistress to the king's pleasure, Taita," he told me, in high girlish tones so incongruous with such a large frame. He had been gelded before puberty. "Is she ready?" "There has been a small mishap," I explained, and led him through to see Lostrice for himself. He puffed out his rouged cheeks with consternation when he saw her condition. "What can I tell Pharaoh?" he cried. "He will have me beaten. I will not do it. The woman is your responsibility. You must answer to the king and stand before his wrath." It was not a duty that I relished, but Aton's distress was real, and at least I had my medical status to afford me some protection from the king's frustrated expectations. Reluctantly, I agreed to accompany him to the royal bedchamber. However, I made sure that there was one of the older and more reliable slave maids in attendance in my mistress's outer chamber before I left her alone. Pharaoh had removed his crown and his wig. His head was shaved as bare and white as an ostrich egg. The effect startled even me, and I wondered how my mistress would have responded to the sight. I doubt that it would have raised either her ardour or her opinion of him. The king seemed as startled to see me as I was to see him. We stared at each other for a moment before I fell to my knees and made my obeisance. "What is this, Taita the slave? I sent for another. Merciful Pharaoh, on behalf of the Lady Lostrice, I come to beg your understanding and indulgence." I launched into a harrowing description of my Lady Lostrice's condition, larding it with obscure medical terms and explanations that were intended to divert the royal appetite. Aton stood beside me, nodding in emphatic corroboration of all I had to say. I am sure that it would not have worked with a younger and more vigorous bridegroom, ready and raring to get to the business. But Mimosa was an old bull. It would have been impossible to tally all the lovely women who over the past 30 years or so had enjoyed his services. In single file they'd probably have circled the city of Thebes of 100 gates, probably more than once. "Your Majesty," Aton interrupted my explanations at last, "with your permission I will fetch you another female companion for the night. Perhaps the little Hurrian with the unusual control of her—" "No, no," the king dismissed him. "There'll be plenty of time for it when the child has recovered from her indisposition. Leave us now, Chamberlain. There is some other matter that I wish to discuss with the doctor. I mean, with the slave." As soon as we were alone, the king lifted his shift to display his belly. "What do you think is the cause of this, doctor?" I examined the rash that adorned his protuberant paunch, and found it to be an infestation of the common ringworm. Some of the royal women washed less frequently than is desirable in our hot climate. I have noted that filth and the contagious itch go together. The king had probably contracted the infection from one of them. "Is it dangerous? Can you cure it, doctor?" Fear makes commoners of us all. He was deferring to me now, as would any other patient. With his permission, I went to my quarters to fetch my medicine chest, and when I returned, I ordered him to lie on the ornate gold and ivory marquetry bed, while I massaged an ointment into the inflamed red circle of skin on his belly. The ointment was of my own concoction, and would heal the rash within 3 days, I assured him. "In a great measure you are responsible for the fact that I have married this child who is your new mistress," he told me as I worked. "Your ointment may cure my rash, but will your other treatment provide me with a son?" he demanded. "These are troubled times. I must have an heir before I am another year older. The dynasty is in jeopardy." We physicians are always reluctant to guarantee our cures, but then so is the lawyer and the astrologer. While I procrastinated, he gave me the escape I was searching for. "I am no longer a young man, Taita. You are a doctor, and I can tell you this. My weapon has been in many a fierce battle. Its blade is no longer as keen as once it was. Of late it has failed me when I most had need of it. Do you have something in that box of yours that would stiffen the wilting stem of the lily?" "Pharaoh, I am pleased that you have discussed this with me. Sometimes the gods work in mysterious ways." We both made the sign to avert evil before I went on. "Your first congress with my virgin mistress must be perfectly executed. Any faltering, any bending from our purpose, any failure to raise on high the royal sceptre of your manhood will frustrate our efforts. There will be only one opportunity. The first union must be successful. If we have to try again, there will be the danger of your fathering yet another female." My medical grounds for this prognosis were rather insubstantial. Nevertheless, we both looked grave, he graver than I did. I held up my forefinger. "Had we made the attempt tonight, and—" I said no more, but let my forefinger droop suggestively, and shook my head. "No, we are fortunate to have been given another chance by the gods." "What must we do?" he demanded anxiously, and I was silent for a long while, kneeling in deep thought beside his bed. It was difficult not to let my relief and satisfaction become apparent. Within the first day of my mistress's marriage, I was already working my way into a position of influence with the king, and I had been offered a perfect excuse for keeping her maidenhead intact for at least a little longer, long enough perhaps for me to be able to prepare her for the brutal shock of her first act of procreation with a man whom she did not love, and who was indeed physically distasteful to her. I told myself that with clever management of the situation I might be able to draw out this period of grace indefinitely. "Yes, indeed, Your Majesty, I can help you, but it will take some time. It will not be as easy as curing this rash." My mind was racing. I had to wring every drop out of the sponge. "We will have to go on to a very strict diet." "No more bull's balls, I beseech you, doctor." "I think you've had enough of those now. However, we will need to warm your blood and sweeten your generative fluids for the fateful attempt. Goat's milk, warm goat's milk, and honey, 3 times a day, and, of course, the special potions I will prepare for you from the horn of the rhinoceros and the root of the mandrake." He looked relieved. "You are certain this will work?" "It has never failed before. But there is one other measure that is essential." "What is that?" His relief evaporated, and he sat up and peered at me anxiously. "Complete abstinence. You must allow the royal member to rest and regain its full strength and force once again. You must forsake your harem and all its pleasures for a while." I said this with the dogmatic air of the physician that cannot be gainsaid, for it was the one sure way to ensure that my Lady Lostris would remain untouched. However, I was worried by what his reaction would be. He could conceivably have flown into a rage at the thought of being denied his conjugal pleasures. He might have rejected me, and I could have lost all the advantage that I had so newly won. But I had to take the risk for the benefit of my mistress. I had to protect her just as long as I was able. The king's reaction surprised me. He simply lay back on his headrest and smiled complacently to himself. "For how long?" he asked quite cheerfully. And I was struck by the realization that my strictures had come as a relief to him. For me, to whom the act of love with a beautiful woman would always be an unattainable and elusive dream, it took an immense effort to understand that Pharaoh was content to be relieved of a once pleasurable duty that, by reason of being so often performed, had become onerous. There must have been at least 300 wives and concubines in his harem at that time, and some of those Asian women were notorious for their insatiable appetites. I tried to sympathize with the effort that it must require to act like a god night after night and year after year. The prospect did not daunt me, as the actuality seemed to have wearied the king. 90 days, I said. 90 days, he repeated thoughtfully. 9 Egyptian weeks of 10 days each? At least, I said firmly. Very well. He nodded without rancour and changed the subject easily. My chamberlain tells me, doctor, that apart from your medical skills, you are also one of the 3 most eminent astrologers in this very Egypt of ours. I wondered why my friend the chamberlain had qualified his assertion. For the life of me I could not think who the other 2 might be. But I inclined my head modestly. He flatters me, your majesty, but perhaps I do have some little knowledge of the heavenly bodies. Cast a horoscope for me, he ordered, sitting up eagerly. Now? I asked with surprise. Now, he agreed. Why not? For on your orders there is nothing that I should rather be doing at this moment. That unexpected smile of his was really quite endearing, and despite what he meant to Tanus and my mistress, I found myself liking him. I shall have to fetch some of my scrolls from the palace library. We have all night, he pointed out. Fetch whatever you need. The exact time and date of the king's birth were well documented, and I had in the scrolls all the observations of the movements of the heavenly bodies made by 50 generations of astrologers before me. While the king watched avidly, I made the first cast of the royal horoscope, and before I had half finished it, I saw the character of the man as I had observed it, perfectly endorsed by his stars. The great red wandering star that we know as the Eye of Seth dominated his destiny. It was the star of conflict and uncertainty, of confusion and war, of sadness and misfortune, and in the end, of violent death. But how could I tell him all these things? I extemporized and put together a scantily veiled resume of the well-documented facts of his life, and laced these with a few less well-known details that I had gathered from my spies, one of whom was the royal chamberlain. Then I followed with the usual assurances of good health and long life that every client wants to hear. The king was impressed. You have all the skills that your reputation made me expect. Thank you, your majesty. I am pleased that I have been able to be of service. I began to gather up my scrolls and my writing instruments, preparatory to taking my leave. It was very late by now. From the darkness beyond the palace walls I had already heard the first cockerel crow. Wait, Taita. I have not given you permission to leave. You have not told me what I really want to know. Will I have a son, and will my dynasty survive? Alas, Pharaoh, those matters cannot be predicted by the stars. They can give only the general inclination of your fate and the overall direction that your life will take without making clear such details. Ah, yes, he interrupted me. But there are other means of seeing into the future, are there not? I was alarmed by the direction in which his questions were leading, and I attempted to head him off, but he was determined. You interest me, Taita, and I have made inquiry about you. You were an adept of the mazes of Amun-Ra. I was distressed. How had he found this out? Very few knew of this esoteric gift of mine, and I wanted it to remain thus. However, I could not blatantly deny it, so I remained silent. I saw the mazes hidden at the bottom of your medicine chest, he said, and I was relieved that I had not attempted to deny my gift and been caught out in the lie. I shrugged with resignation, for I knew what was coming. Work the mazes for me, and tell me if I am to have an heir and whether or not my dynasty will survive, he ordered. A horoscope is one thing. It requires only a knowledge of the configuration of the stars and their properties. Some little patience and the correct procedure will result in a fairly accurate prediction. A divination by the mazes of Amun-Ra is another matter entirely. It requires an expenditure of the life forces, a burning up of something deep inside the seer that leaves him worn out and exhausted. These days I will go to lengths to avoid having to exercise this gift. It is true that on rare occasions I can still be persuaded to work the mazes, but then for days thereafter I am spiritually and physically depleted. My Lady Lostries, who knows of this strange power of mine, also knows of the effect it has upon me, and she has forbidden me, for my own sake, to practice it, except occasionally on her behalf. However, a slave cannot deny a king. And with a sigh I reached for the leather bag in the bottom of my chest that contained the mazes. I set the bag aside and prepared a mixture of the herbs that are necessary to open the eyes of the soul, to enable them to look into the future. I drank the potion and then waited until the familiar but dreaded sensation of rising out of my own body assailed me. I felt dreamy and far from reality as I brought out the leather bag which contained the mazes.